take some questions and then speak.
My name is Morale Kuftar. I'm from the place that everybody forget to mention the man, especially the first gentleman and the second gentleman. We talk about the hot spots where they have conflicts. I think Palestine, this case is in 60 years. And I think it starts the whole thing after the Second World War. They sent us the Israeli, so here they live in peace. And we live in this kind of conflict there since 60 years. So I think we ask for justice maybe now. To be in the map at least, like we have a war there, or we have something there, or people be killing there. And we can say it's like 1 year now from the war against Gaza, and everybody saw this in the TV, and they saw how many thousands of tons of weapons and phosphoric bombs they used against the people there, and how they killed the people there. And this, I'm sure, will affect the climate, about the CO2 and all this stuff. Thank you.
Nancy Lindisfarne, International Socialist, I'm from Britain. I don't think any of us in this room really disagree with what we've heard here. I think we want to go further, to go to the next step. And I'd like to name what I think is the elephant in the room. The elephant is the real politics fighting the imperialism that we've heard described in various ways, and the imperial competitions which are fueling the climate change which you are facing. I would ask the speakers and all of us here to turn ourselves to a question of practical politics. What is to be done? How are we actually to face this elephant? How are we to force the imperial governments how can we organize to force the imperial governments to deal with the unequal power that is actually needs urgently to be redressed to address climate change? Let us actually go for the elephant and think what we can do to organize, please.
I speak for a government. The government of Aceh. We are at war. Still. We have been at war for 150 years. The present war, anybody doesn't know where Aceh is, well, you've heard of the tsunami. We are now fighting against a new tsunami to protect a new war to protect our tropical rainforests. We have the largest remaining expanse of tropical rainforests left in Southeast Asia. We are fighting a war against a new army because the first partial destruction of our tropical rainforests was by an army, by a war, a hot war of arms and weapons and stealing forests and cutting them down at gunpoint by the Indonesian army. Now we have peace, we have autonomy. Our first declaration to the world of the Aceh government is called Aceh Green. This is to make Aceh into the world's first environmentally prioritized country. That is something, and we are a government. And in conflict, ideologically, therefore, with the Indonesian government, which is the third most polluting country in the world, not because of its cars, not because of its factories, but because it cuts forests to plant palm oil. We are fighting a tsunami, a regular army of ranks and ranks of these hideous, destructive trees which destroy the land, deprive the farmers of new land to produce food, and tropical rainforests are Aceh's heritage, and Aceh for one will defend these forests to the last tree until the doomsday which global warming very clearly Aceh needs your support and the support of other governments in the world. At the moment, the governments of the world are discussing what can we do to reward people for keeping their tropical rainforests. Indeed, Aceh is defending its forests because forests are its heritage. Aceh are heroic people. I regret not bringing some Acehese with me today because they came from Aalborg. There is a small community of Acehese there. They're all political refugees from war. And during that war, the tropical forests were cut down, some of them. But we still have, of 1,300 tigers left in Southeast Asia, we have 1,000. And elephants, and so on. We are defending them. We will defend them. We ask the world to recognize Aceh well and give it thanks, because thank you to the world for your help in the tsunami. And this is an act of thanks that we give, and we preserve our forests for the world.
Very short comment. I definitely agree that the Middle East and Palestine is a hotspot in the future, with climate change adding to existing conflict. So I think it will make the situation worse. My second point was the question on whether conflict or cooperation will be succeeding. I think it will be a competition of both, because this is a choice not only for the world, but it's a choice each of us has. So each of us can have a conflicting mode of behavior or a cooperative mode of behavior, and that sometimes depends on the situation. But the general principle should be to overcome conflict in a cooperative way and solving them, that they don't turn violent. Conflict are part of society, they are something natural, but it's very important which way we address conflict between us. It should definitely be not violent, but should be solution-oriented. And my hope for the future is that in the end, the cooperative approach is, between us will succeed. And this is linked to the question is how we will act, how we will, or what kind of politics we will come up with. Solving the climate problem is not only a technical issue, as it is often discussed. Joachim mentioned efficiency is the key term here. But it's not only technical efficiency that matters, it's societal efficiency that matters. If you have a society that's full of conflict and it's full of violence and full of wars, it's a tremendous loss of resources, natural resources, but also human resources. In a conflicting situation, we all apply all our efforts to achieve our goals against someone. And that someone also applies his or her resources against us. And in the end, we are all worse off in that conflict. So that's a tremendous waste of resources. And for that reason, I would call for anything that improves the societal efficiency, that we act together. That means we merge our resources to achieve common goals. And politics that is directed in this direction is, I think, is something we have to work on. Participatory approaches to government and participatory approaches to democracy. I think these are the most important political messages I think we can apply to solve the climate problem and other problems in the future. Okay, and just a short comment on the palm oil. I think there's no excuse to eradicate the rainforest, either for food or for fuel.
Let me start with the Aceh intervention here. I completely agree that with the speaker, it's a good sign that was reached yesterday or the day before, that in the red agreement that's now being prepared here on reducing deforestation and degradation of forests, then the rights of the indigenous people will now be explicitly mentioned. And this applies also to the Aceh people. And if such an outcome here will be reached, that a substantial transfer of resources to the third world will be agreed, then it should be ascertained that this will not go to corrupt governments like the present Indonesian government, but rather distributed to those like the Aceh people, like the autonomous Aceh region, where the effect can be best achieved. About Palestine, I agree that perhaps the climate effects of the war can perhaps not be measured, but certainly this has been a war that where environmental destruction has been used as a weapon in that war systematically, and that is a shame that the conditions of living or the basic means of existing for the Palestine people have been systematically destroyed and reduced, and also the cultural infrastructure has been systematically destroyed. So this is certainly a bad and thought-provoking example of how environmental warfare can be fought. And of course, I agree with Jürgen also that in the future the whole Middle East can be a source of conflict, also on the nuclear scene, where they can have a nuclear triangle between Israel, Syria and Iran, with very devastating consequences for the area. And what should we do about the imperialist elephant? We should remember that the elephant also has sore toes, and we can prick into those toes and try to... The elephant is not completely insensible to effects of public opinion and of the actions of other countries. We should just not go along with the elephant, and we should say no and point to alternative behavior and take action according to that. I don't think the elephant is that unvulnerable.
But about the questions, one point is about the Near East and the wars in the region. First of all, one example of the indirect effect of wars, my former boss Mr. Schmidt-Blake has once calculated that the total resource consumption for the first 2 years of the last Iraq war would have been enough in physical resources like material, construction material and so forth, to build decent housing for 1 billion people on the earth. And when you ask about how many people don't have decent housing on the earth, then you are close to that figure. So that is also the kind of indirect effect which is shocking. Secondly, you cannot talk to anybody in the Near East from the Israel, Jordanian or Palestinian side who does not know that behind very many discussions and negotiations is the unspoken issue of groundwater of the Jordan River. And that this is mainly pumped by Israel, and the Palestinians are deprived from its use. And that is that the Israeli agriculture, which is famous all over the world, cannot exist without Palestinian groundwater. And that makes a very big conflict for the future. And that is not easy to solve. On the other hand, as Jürgen has mentioned, the most promising initiatives for collaboration I know, for example, like Friends of the Earth Middle East, or like other cultural cooperation centers, where people from the Palestinian side, the Israeli side, and the neighboring countries like Syria or Jordan are sitting together and really working together, also actively promoting things at risk in their own societies. This is people who are working on water problems. So it stimulates both the collaboration, but so far, unfortunately, the collaboration is a minority and the rest is a majority. Two last points. One point is, we have not realized we have to change our lifestyles. We try to change a few things to be not forced to change the big things. For example, we try not to abolish car driving and instead go for biofuels. Either we produce them from food or we produce them from plant oil, which is therefore also called deforestation diesel in Asia. Deforestation diesel. And why do we do that? Because we cannot give up car driving. So that is, we have to change our habits much more radically, not to have first the fuel cell and then the biodiesel and now the electric mobility. And what do you know next comes? Just another gadget to pretend that we can essentially stay as we are. We can't. That is why I think the next big discussion should be, are we prepared for the life after growth? What is a post-growth society? And that means, and that is my last sentence, that means that we are not living, or we should not be living with the illusion that conflicts of distribution could be solved by growth. So nobody has to sacrifice anything because we distribute what is there in growth. In future that won't be possible. People must sacrifice some of what they have if we want to have more justice in the world. And that is simply because people don't see the necessity, probably a safe receipt for some more conflict in the future time, which is first of all a social conflict, and we have to learn to organize social conflicts and to win them, because otherwise we're going to have the military conflicts and the violent conflicts we have been warning about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And this will be the last questions.
Max Andersson from the Swedish Green Party. I have a difficult question that I don't know the answer to, and I suspect you don't either, but I'm asking for an answer here the same. Many people, at least some, say that the role of Western militaries should be today to promote peace, peacekeeping, protecting refugees in poorer parts of the world. But even today, those resources are strained. If a major country, like, say, Nigeria, should collapse, well, the resources would probably not be sufficient. Now, I don't know what one should do, and I am certainly not advocating a massive multiplication of military, the size of world militaries. I don't think that would be a good idea. But in the future, that is unfortunately not unlikely. If we don't do something about the climate now, what are we going to do to promote peace and keep this world a somewhat good place to live for everybody?
Yeah, you talk about the people that sit together, like Jordanian, Syrian, Israeli, and Palestinian. So they start this peace process since 1993 when Arafat came back to Palestine. But we lost from the land since 1993 until now more than 46% of West Bank. And we talk about peace process and negotiation. So how come if we have no negotiation now?
Hi, Christopher Anderson, no political association. My question is, who is doing the right thing now? So I think the questions we've had here before have shown very clear that talking about conflicts, it is very difficult not to get entrenched in the existing conflicts. Who are the good examples here? Who are able to, out in the world, discuss prevention of future conflicts without getting entrenched in existing conflicts?
I would like to thank all of you for coming here. I hope you have learned a lot, as I have done. And I hope that you will use all what you have learned to the big problem we have to fight them, and I hope that you will be able to be more active and do more together with your fellows in your hometown or home country. But it has been a pleasure that you have come here, and I would like to thank you for that. And then the speakers will end up.
Thank you. Let me start with the question from Max Andersson about how to cope with the coming perhaps climate-generated conflict, since we have our hands full already today with the conflict. Now we should keep in mind that although the Western world uses a huge amount of money on military and armaments, this money is not used in the right way for peacekeeping activities at all. It's building up a war fighting capacity, a war fighting between advanced nations. This is where most of the money goes, and most of the resources are wasted on this. If we were to concentrate on peacekeeping and on also on the civilian forms of peacekeeping, I think the resources that we are using on military armaments today are sufficient, completely sufficient for that. I mean, we are using them for the wrong kinds of weapons, the wrong kinds of equipment, the wrong kind of training. I think there are certainly resources, and it's very typical that those countries which are most active in peacekeeping keeping activities today, they are the African countries. Nigeria is actually one of them. And they have put their eggs in the right basket and at least use them in a more sensible way. Well, good examples for the future, I don't know. Maybe I will leave that more difficult question for Jürgen and Joachim.
I think it's important to understand that the peace through war hypothesis is fundamentally flawed. I mean, what you see is basically in all recent conflicts is that the military approach has aggravated the situation and has not solved it. Of course, it's sometimes possible if you have a dominant military power to control the country for a while, maybe even achieve your goals as the emperor or the invader. But that doesn't mean it solves the conflict, and it certainly kills the people you want to supposedly protect. So it also undermines and destroys the resources of the country. So I would object to the thesis that the military is an adequate way of solving the conflict. But you need to think about the conditions for peace in the long run. You need to prepare them. Even if in a conflict situation, you need to think about how you create the conditions for peace, and the environment is an important ingredient for it. There are other factors such as enough wealth for the people, enough health for the people, enough institutions to stabilize society, law, and all these factors are all important. It's more important to work for these factors rather than using the military to control the violence. For that reason, I would say Obama's speech in Oslo this week was more a Nobel war lecture than a Nobel peace lecture, because he was basically justifying the military as a major instrument of United States policy in the future to achieve peace, as he says. But he's using fundamental humanitarian principles for partial interest. That's, is a main point of critique, because if the U.S. is using military force, it's basically serving U.S. interests. And it's not serving humanitarian interests. And that's always the risk, at least the people in the region see it this way. And for that reason, it's more important to think what he mentioned in the second part of his lecture, to think about the conditions for peace. But even in that part, he was basically always blaming bad guys for violating the conditions for peace. And he never mentioned the United States. And it was mentioned, for instance, climate change is a major conflict factor in the future, but in the second part of that sentence he says the military in the United States is looking into this problem of the climate threat. So I think it's more important to create the conditions, as I mentioned, for peace, and via sustainable development, I think, is a key ingredient of that. The threat is not the other, the threat is ourselves. And this is something the United States in particular has to understand. The threat doesn't come from outside, it comes from inside. And the responses to use the military for that is the wrong response.
Three points. First of all, to Palestine, to clarify a misunderstanding. If you look at the UN plan for the division of Palestine between Israel and the Palestinian state of 1948, and you see that Palestinians have lost much more than the 40%, so they have been treated unfair since the very beginning. The point is that so far no Israeli government has been really willing to make peace. The only prime minister who tried to has been shot by Israeli extremists, and so far there has been not a fair negotiation. It was a betrayal from the very beginning, full stop. So when I talk about hopeful collaboration, I talk about the NGO world. I talk about scientists which collaborate, I talk about environmental organizations which collaborate. I see that in the civil society there is efforts to use this situation for more humanitarian understanding and mutual support, but I don't see that on the political level so far, at least so with the current Israeli government. Full stop. So just clarifying that. Then the two other questions, good examples. I have to admit that I didn't fully understand the question, but that is probably the same situation that my colleagues here had. I think what I tell people is they should look for Europe as a good example. We have a continent which has been defined more or less by permanent wars in all parts of the continent. And look how we live now. We still had too many wars in the southeast of the continent. We had a peaceful time in the rest of it. Denmark and Sweden would not go to war against each other at the moment. And I hope that this stays like that. And it has to do with a situation where mutual dependency was there. It had to do with a situation where mutual acceptance was there. And where collaboration and knowing each other better was replacing preoccupations. So I don't think that any of the European solutions is directly transposable to anybody else, but I invite everybody from other continents to have a look at Europe and draw their own conclusions. And I think that is an example for me. And that also shows that we do not have any kind of enforced peacemaking which was successful. Only agreed peacemaking was successful. And as Jürgen just said, simply an army is the wrong tool for creating peace, or as we used to say when I was younger, fighting for peace is like fucking for virginity.
Well, at the end, I would like to thank all of you, above all for your patience. I would like to thank the organizers for helping us to find the space here so that everyone could take part at the meeting. And at the end, I would like to thank the second moderator, Nina, and I would like to thank the speakers, I think, for the very impressive speeches, giving a lot of information to you and to us, and hopefully we will see each other again, somewhere on the street or in a room, continue the discussion. Have a good evening. Thank you.